Group meeting, Saturday, 19th September, 1987. Last time, we finished the chapter dealing with Moses. And now, we begin with the chapter which deals with Prajapati Parameshthin, which is the pseudonym for the poet seer who wrote the famous creation hymn in the Rig Veda, the 10th book, hymn 129. So this is how the chapter starts and goes. Heaven endures constant. Earth changes her garb whensoever heaven's light enfolds her. Heaven's light is invisible. 'Tis earth which refracts the unknown light and drapes herself in flashing colors for our soul's delight. The communion is timeless and measureless. In its heavenly state, it is eternally silent. When earth nestles in heaven, man sings of the silence, a song of creation. And creation itself, like heaven, is constant, invisible, unknown. The communion is timeless and measureless, that we all understand. In its heavenly state, I've used the word heavenly there, meaning, of course, in its transcendent state, it is eternally silent, because the state of communion is a state of silence. None of the noise of our thinking, feeling, doing, and so on interferes with that silence. And it is in that state of silence that in holistic consciousness, mind you, that's a term I've never used in this book, in holistic consciousness, one is conscious of that silence which speaks its message. It's an extraordinary mode of awareness. So, when earth, which represents ourselves, nestles in heaven, man sings of the silence, a song of creation, because it is that transcendent consciousness which is continuously creative. It never ceases. We think that when we read our scriptures, whatever the religion may be, we think that creation took place once and for all. The whole business started, you see. But God is not a shopkeeper. Doesn't start a business and then just goes on with it. Lets it go on by itself. Creation and the creative energy is constantly active. That is something which we are unaware of. The hint of it is given in the Bhagavad Gita, actually, when Krishna says to Arjuna, Arjuna, if I did not engage constantly in action, these worlds would fall into ruin. What does action there mean when Krishna, the incarnate Lord, the God of the universe, as he is worshipped in India, says that? Action means creative action and nothing else. And it deals with the transcendent context of the infinite and the eternal. Creation itself, like heaven, is constant, invisible, unknown. We don't know really what creation is. But one can suggest certain things about it. I won't start on that now because I've been developing that somewhat more fully in the new book. And it'll be there. Whatever I can say about it will be there. It's too much to talk about in a few minutes. It matters not when a man lived. 1,000 ages ago, if heaven touched him, he stood in silent wonder, and afterward, perhaps he made a sound, his hymn of creation. That sound was a call for whoso cared heavenward. And it's a sound which is made by the Creator, by creation itself. Not the process of creation, but creation. You hear it in the songs of birds, in the rustling of leaves, and so on and so on. All through nature, nature hears that call, knows that call. Not in our sense of the word knowing with the brain, which can be talked about in words. It's not like that. It's an extraordinary thing altogether. For us, it is an unknowing knowing. Unknowing in the sense that it cannot really be described completely. Or perhaps he saw a bird or a beast, a rock or a tree, and this became the sign of the holy. You all know about totems and totemism and so on. The sign of the holy. The tides of time flowed on. Heaven endures constant, but earth grew older and richer in color, and man, her child, grown to power of speech, was drawn more often to more intimate communion. The benediction of heaven is the same 100 ages ago as it is 1,000 ages ago. It is ever the same. Only earth and man had changed and grown. Because transcendence is immutable. It is changeless. Prajapati Parameshthin sings his song of creation. Now this name, Prajapati Parameshthin, you may remember I've often said that the pseudonyms which those poet seers employed are indicative of the state of consciousness which they actually realized. Prajapati means Lord of creatures. All creatures on earth are the creation of Prajapati. He's the Lord of creatures. Of course, all this is anthropomorphized, because in those days it was impossible to talk in any other way than anthropomorphically. And Parameshthin means the Supreme Lord. Lord of creatures, the Supreme God. It's an extraordinary thing that those people who had completely gone past all conceit, all self-conceit or pride, who were perfected holy ones, adopted pseudonyms like this. It sounds frightfully conceited, doesn't it? To sign yourself Lord of creatures, Supreme God. I don't know whether you all know about this story. It's a true story. It was told me by somebody who had been as a visitor to a mental hospital, not very far from here, northeastwards. And three of them were in the room, and one of them said, "I was Napoleon." And the second fellow said, "No, you were not Napoleon. You never were Napoleon." "I was Napoleon." "How do you know?" "God told me." And the third chap said, "I did not." Now, this is the famous hymn. "Then was not non-existent or nor existent. There was no realm of air, no sky beyond it. What covered in, and where, and what gave shelter? Was water there, unfathomed depth of water?" Neither non-existent nor existent was there. After we die, after the organism dies, it becomes non-existent. That is to say, not existing in terms of a manifested organic being or form. So the living state and the state after one has completed one's life is the existent state, the living, and the non-existent state. But the non-existent state is not an identifiable entity. That is one of the great mistakes which religious philosophy has made through millennia, to think that that is an existent state, an identifiable entity, who was the very entity in the existent state, as John Smith or Mary Brown here, and so forth. You see? But the non-existent state does not mean annihilation. It is the return of all the elements composing the existent being, the psychophysical being, the return of those elements to their source from which they come. You see, each person in his lifetime affects the totality. And that effect remains as an energy. If the existent beings, if I, for example, or you, for example, were to completely fulfill all the purpose of your existence here, then there will be no energy of any sort in the non-existent state which will need to come back. The non-existent state is a universal thing. It is not a particular thing. I, the particular person, Firoz Mehta, completely disappear at death. But that energy which was here as me is there, one with the total creative energy. And if I have not fulfilled all the purposes of my existence here, not purposes as I desire them or conceive of them, but the real purpose of life itself in its transcendence, if I have not fulfilled them, then the total creative energy puts forth another creature, because I haven't fulfilled everything. But if I have fulfilled everything, there is no other creature which that total energy puts forth, which another creature who was the result of what I did, thought, felt in my life here and contributed to the non-existent state. You see, in that sense only, we may think of a rebirth. But I'm pretty certain that what I say is nearer the truth than the commoner garden belief in reincarnation and rebirth which people have. That an identifiable entity comes back. It's no good doing what Christmas Humphreys used to do. He used to say, it's your character that is reborn. But character is our description of the mode in which John Brown functioned in his lifetime. The qualities which represented him. It doesn't refer to any energy which has completely worked out all that it had to work out. It doesn't refer to that, you see. And one has these peculiar ideas for the very simple reason that the person who is living finds it impossible to relinquish the ego. I am, and I am forever and ever. I am not. Once one can really relinquish this idea of a permanent identity, identifiable entity with respect to the ego, then one has fulfilled one of the great purposes of our existence here. One has seen the reality, the truth. But there is no annihilation, remember. For example, when the rain falls on the river or in the sea, it's all the one water, isn't it? The raindrops have lost their identifiable entity as raindrops. But the water is still water. It's the same water. So you see, this fear of death, this dislike of death which people have, is really the fear of the particular ego, I am I, being annihilated. That definitely is annihilated, because there is no I am I consciousness after death. Now, there was not non-existent nor existent. In that supreme state of consciousness, which is possible for human beings to experience, you are aware of this, which is the void in the real sense. But it is a void which is not annihilation. It's not an absolute vacuity. It contains within itself the totality, which never increases or decreases. And then air is mentioned, vayu. But vayu is a word which also means spirit. It's not just, you know, European scholars, and these are translations by European scholars, they have always translated vayu as wind or air. It has nothing to do with wind or air as we know it, a mixture of nitrogen, oxygen and so on. It's nothing to do with that. Vayu is the spirit, stands for the spirit. It was the gift. It also meant atmosphere, but not in our restricted sense of the material atmosphere. And water, of course, we talk of the waters of life, just as we talk of the fire of creation and so forth. So one has to be awake to the symbolism which is involved in these hymns of the Rig Veda. Death was not then, nor was there aught immortal. Now that I don't understand. Death was not then, yes, because death, when you realize holistic consciousness, you see that there is no such thing as death, there is only change. You know, I've often quoted that marvelous passage from The Tempest. Of him nothing doth remain, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. You see, it's like that. But then, nor was there aught immortal, but the transcendent creative energy is immortal. No sign was there, the days and nights divider. That one thing, it's difficult to translate into English the original Vedic, tad ekam. Tad means that, ekam means one. That one. But to call it that one thing is inappropriate. I think Griffiths, mind you, he was a very good translator. Griffiths used the word thing in order to get a sufficient number of syllables in the line. Because Vedic poetry is really quite marvelous the way it's constructed. Apart from it was nothing whatsoever. Darkness there was. At first, concealed in darkness, this all means the universe which we see and know, was indiscriminated chaos. All that existed then was void and formless. You remember how in Genesis said that the earth was void and formless. This idea of the void and the formless and the shapelessness of the ultimate is through all the great religions. Apart from it was nothing whatsoever. Yes, I read that. By the great power of warmth was born that unit. Now, warmth is a literal translation of the word tapas. But I think that in this context, that is not a good translation, but it is a really incorrect translation. Tapas also means attentiveness, concentrated attention. You know how in the Upanishadic teachings, Brahman is described as a trinity in terms of Sat, Chit, Ananda. Sat is, you can translate either as absolute truth or as being, the being, supreme being. Chit is translated by some as consciousness, which is quite a good translation, by some as mind. But in this context, I think it is better to translate it as total attentiveness, complete attentiveness. And Ananda means bliss, Sat Chit Ananda, being, attentiveness and bliss. Now I'll tell you why I think attentiveness is a better translation. You can translate it as consciousness, of course, or as mind. But look, in one of the Zarathustrian scriptures, the Vandidad, we have an extremely interesting statement. Ahura Mazda, the supreme god, constantly repeats the creative word, the Ahuna Vairya. The Hebrews called it the Ma'amar. St. John's Gospel says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. This is the creative word. In the Trismegistic writings, you get a very good interpretation of that. But this Zarathustrian text goes on like this. Because the creative word is repeated ceaselessly, therefore this universe continues to be as it ought to be, perfect, no flaw in it. When there was a pause in the repetition of the creative word, evil entered. Now just think of it in terms of our own life. As and when our consciousness is not of the best sort, you see, it has degenerated in some way or other, evil creeps in. And we have the good old saying, the devil hath work for idle hands. That puts it in its final concrete form, in its concretest form. But evil enters the mind when it is unoccupied with the truly good. See, man has to live with the utmost vigilance, eternal vigilance. You have to watch. Remember what Jesus said, watch and pray, for ye know neither the hour nor the day when the Son of Man cometh. The Son of Man is the Son of Mind, because the Sanskrit root man is the root from which the words man and mind both derive, you see. So, watch all the time. Doesn't mean watch the TV or the traffic in Piccadilly Circus. It means watch the manner in which you are conscious of everything, your environment and yourself, from moment to moment. Watch carefully, you see. When something evil does crop up, because we are still in the subhuman stage, we are not full-fledged humans, don't fight against it. Watch it carefully. Don't think in terms of overcoming evil. Anything to do with conflict is doomed to failure. It just means destruction. Watch it carefully. And in that watching, let that which is not the good flower. Now that's a strange thing to say. Krishnamurti has said that. It's not original to me. He has said, let it flower. Which means this. This is what he hasn't explained in detail. To let it flower means watch it and see how it grows and grows, becomes worse, produces this evil result, that evil result, and so forth. And in that watching, finally, it drops away out of your mind, out of consciousness. Like a scab will drop off after it has formed. You see? You can, of course, scratch it, scrape it off, but it'll bleed again. Another scab will fall. You see the point? This is extremely important. We have lived all these millions of years in terms of conflict. How to be free of conflict is not to enter into conflict, not to try to overcome or fight against anything. Watch it. Understand it. And in that understanding, the purification takes place, and transcendent love in your consciousness transmutes the evil into good. It's not easy to see these things, and it's more difficult to carry them out, to follow them. But try, because you have to try. Try and try again. Remember, was it Robert the Bruce, the Scotchman, who saw a spider, you know, come down from and build a web, and then he sort of came down. Then he tried to get up, and he failed 7 times. He tried to get back to his web. He failed 7 times, but the last time he finally got there. And Robert the Bruce, therefore, took that as a lesson and fought against the English and won. Battle of Bannockburn, wasn't it? Come on, anybody remember your history? That was... Now, you see, you have to try and try and try again until it happens. But there is an art in trying. Robert the Bruce tried, took the lesson of trying again and again in order to obtain a result for himself. Where human life is concerned and human perfection is concerned, you must be free of the desire to gain this particular result for yourself. Because to make an effort in order to obtain a good result for oneself is still selfness. It's self-centered, isn't it? Be free of the self-centeredness. Then you will realize that your trying will not only result in something which is good for you, but it will be good for all humanity. Because the individual consciousness affects the total consciousness of mankind. So whatever result, a good result accrues out of your understanding and is something which affects all mankind. Of course, one may say we see very little sign of it in the world, in spite of the goodness of so many good people and so on. But we have to be infinitely patient. There's no getting away from that. So, by the great power of warmth was born that unit. Attentiveness, tapas, attentiveness, by the power of attentiveness. Thereafter rose karma. The Sanskrit, the Vedic word is karma, which he has translated as desire, which is the commoner garden translation. Eros is not only desire in the erotic sense, but it is the creative energy which confers immortality upon all the gods. Eros is the one who confers immortality upon the whole lot of gods. You see? So it is of that nature, a creative nature, a transmutative nature. So, karma here, whilst it does mean erotic desire too, really in this context should mean transcendent love. Desire, karma, the primal seed and germ of spirit. It's the seed and germ of spirit. Sages who searched with their heart's thought discovered the existence kinship in the non-existent. who searched with their heart's thought. What is the meaning of heart's thought? We know what our ordinary thinking is, the ordinary chatter that goes on in our brain. We know that. But what is the heart's thought? The word, the Sanskrit word hridaya, means the physical heart as well as heart in the sense in which in the English language we say the heart of the matter. You see? When a person truly says, I love you with all my heart, he means not just his physical heart, but the heart represents the essential being. So, with their heart's thought, thought here will mean not just as a series of words. It means that mode of attention with your whole being, which enables you to be aware of the reality, the truth. That is your heart's thought. Discovered the existence, kinship in the non-existent. The existent, the manifested, which we are aware of through our senses, sight, hearing, touch, and so on. You see? We are akin. We have a completely, we are in fact completely interrelated with the non-existent. The non-existent is a unity, a one non-existent. Every single human being who, when after he dies, is part of that unity, of that non-existent. Now, this is what I have not solved. Transversely was their severing line extended. What was above it then, and what below it? There were begetters, there were mighty forces. Free action here, and energy up yonder. I think it may be possibly related to the statement in Genesis 1, the waters above the firmament and the waters below the firmament. You see. Free action here and energy up yonder. Who verily knows, and who can here declare it, whence it was born, and whence comes this creation? The gods are later than this world's production. Who knows then whence it first came into being? The gods are later than this world's production. Why? How? Ordinarily, one would think that the gods come first and other creatures come afterwards. Not at all. The gods are the result of man's anthropomorphizing. Man is wise. That is the god of wisdom. With the Greeks, it was the goddess Athena. You see? The god has wisdom in supreme degree. Man created all these gods out of his brain. He anthropomorphized and he apotheosized. Presented in terms of perfection what he had. Actually, man himself is all the gods and goddesses of all the pantheons of the world. You yourself, I myself, are all these gods and goddesses. I am Zeus, I am Hera, I am Apollo, I am Hermes. You see, and so on and so on. So we have to understand that all that composes us. The Brihadaranyaka Upanishad has a wonderful statement amongst its hundreds of wonderful statements. Man is made up of everything. That's the god Indra. Jupiter sending a thunderbolt. Sorry. But there we are. You see, we are all the gods and goddesses. Some of those gods represent us in perfection. Other gods and goddesses are rather rascally, and they represent our imperfections. Again, the Upanishads have been very wonderful that way. In the Chandogya Upanishad, one of the great Upanishads. And these are all pre-Buddhistic, remember. It is said that Prajapati was the creator of the gods and the demons, the Suras and the Asuras. And the Asuras, the demons, were the older ones. They are the ones, that is to say, they all represent energies. They are the energies which produce discord, which produce chaos, disorder, and a hell of a mess. That's what the demons mean. They are also concerned, those energies are concerned with the dissolution and disruption of particular forms which have outlived their usefulness. Whatever outlives its usefulness, after all, take the simplest common garden case. You get a house which is pretty derelict. What do? The housebreakers come along and demolish it. The demolishers demolish it. And then on that ground you can raise up a new good house in good order. Isn't that so? It's like that. So the demons represent that aspect of things. They are the demolishers of what has outlived its... And they are also the devils in the real sense, the inspirers, I should say the misinspirers of evil things. The devil comes and tempts you. But you know, that's very good of him. He tries you out. And if he doesn't try you out, how will you know that you have truly realized this state? So you see, make friends with the devil. I am the devil. And I am God. That is the fact. In the old days, it was impossible, especially in spheres like Christendom and the world of Islam, to say such things. You would have been tortured to death if you said such things, you see. But that is the truth. Hinduism and Buddhism have been the most liberal and intelligent religions in that respect, in this respect. So, the gods are later than this world's production. Who knows then whence it first came into being? Then he goes, this last verse is tremendously important. He, the first origin of this creation, whether he formed it all or did not form it, whose eye controls this world in highest heaven, he verily knows it, or perhaps he knows not. Now, if you want the summit of agnostic, completely open-minded inquiry, You have it in this verse of the Rig Veda. He in highest heaven, perhaps he knows it, or perhaps he knows not. Therefore it behoves us to inquire and to find out for ourselves.